Hello and welcome to what is now Season 5 of Pebble in the Pond podcast. My name is Sam Stewart and I am the CEO of the Australian and New Zealand Mental Health Association. Each year, ANZMHA hosts several leading mental health conferences which give us the opportunity to connect with incredible industry leaders, lived experience speakers, researchers, academics and frontline workers as they share fascinating stories and projects which are changing the face of mental health within our community. Listen in as we go one-on-one with these inspiring people and dive deep into their work. It is truly a privilege to bring you their stories. Our podcast episodes may contain content which could be triggering for some people. If you need support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit the Get Help page on anzmh.asn.au. Join us for Pebble in the Pond each Tuesday and let's get into Season 5. On today's episode, we speak with Commissioner Dominic Morgan. With over 30 years of ambulance experience across a broad range of roles in the areas of operations, clinical practice and leadership within ambulance services and the financial sector, Commissioner Morgan has an incredible amount of experience and insight. We chat about the recent ramifications of the pandemic on paramedics and what the future holds for the sector. Thank you, Commissioner, and welcome. Commissioner Dominic Morgan, thanks so much for having me on with me and sharing your story, your journey, your insights with our listeners. Appreciate your time.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Sam.
Dom, do you want to tell our listeners, give them a bit of context as to where it all started with you for your interest in ambulance, paramedics? Where did that come from? Was it in the family, something you always wanted to do? How did it come about?
It's probably all a bit of both, really. Pretty much my background was that, you know, went through high school like most people, not really knowing what they wanted to do. And I did have a brother who worked in an ambulance service interstate. And anyway, that had always sort of been sitting in the background as maybe something. And like a lot of people, you often get drawn to your profession through, you know, some piece of adversity. And I remember coming across this really big car crash once. And, you know, there I was at sort of 17 years of age and the ambos turn up and they start rescuing this patient and treating them. And, you know, I guess with the background in the family, it was like, that's what I'm going to do. And wow. And most paramedics you'll actually find will have a very similar story of where they got exposed to it at some point or another.
So you just sort of knew that this is something, helping people, seeing that come in and do their job. You're like, this is what an awesome profession and opportunity it could be.
Yeah, look, it was, you know, one of those things where you're almost hit instantly and, you know, that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. You know, it was pretty much unambiguous after that time. Once I'd finished school, I didn't go to university, you know, back, not a lot of my friends did at that time either, but I did get a job in a bank and I went off and I became a volunteer ambulance officer. So I used to go to the bank during the day and then I'd go and do a night shift with the team overnight. And that kicked around for probably a year and a half or so. And eventually an opportunity came up for a salary job in New South Wales. So I headed over here and pretty much, apart from 6.5 years, I've been here ever since.
Wow. So that's how it all started for you. So you started work, your first experience or exposure to the ambulance was on the front line as a paramedic?
Absolutely. Yep. So there's really not that many jobs I haven't done in my ambulance career now. I started off as an ambulance officer, as we were called back in those days, at 19 years of age. And then by 22, which is almost ridiculous by today's measures, I was what's called an intensive care. And so that was doing sort of really quite cutting edge and specialist type interventions at that time. And then shortly after that, I became a member of the New South Wales Special Casualty Access Team, which was an elite group of paramedics who were trained to access people in isolated areas. So, you know, I went off to Thredbo and the Beaconsfield mine disaster in Tasmania and a few other different things that I got to do over my career. You know, nobody ever wishes for these terribly tragic events to occur. But from a professional point of view, being able to have the opportunity to go there and, you know, use all your skills to try and make a positive outcome, it's hard to get a job that's more rewarding than that.
That would be incredibly rewarding, wouldn't it, to be part of those, I guess, day-to-day. You get lots of different missions as well that you, you know, would feel inspired, feel very, very much helped and valued by going to help at certain scenes. But to be involved in something like Beaconsfield mine or the, I mean, that would have been quite amazing.
Yeah. Look, it really was the threadbow. But Beaconsfield was an incredible experience. You know, getting, because it was so prolonged, and you know, comparatively, we were talking to these two guys through a 40-centimeter PVC pipe, 20 meters behind a, you know, literally the darkest, heaviest rock that you could ever possibly come across for 8 days was the time that I was down there until they came out.
I don't think there would be too many people that weren't, like, that didn't know where they were when they finally came out, and the coverage that got around Australia, certainly, and probably around the rest of the world as well. But is that what keeps you in doing what you're doing and being a part of such a wonderful organisation?
Oh, the human side of it is what it's all about. It is an absolute privilege to be able to care for people, you know, often when they're not able to care for themselves. And so even though now, as my career's gone on and I've ended up in, you know, what most people would say was a management role, you know, I still get to get out and about. And literally only 2 weeks ago, I was out as a paramedic on the road as part of a second, you know, paramedic on a team, and just reminding myself exactly why you do these jobs.
So you still get to do that then in your current role?
Yeah, look, I've got to say it's few and far between, but COVID was a really good example where I thought it was really, really important to get out on the tools and be out there with the boys and girls while they were doing the hard yards. And it was terribly, terribly difficult to try and look after people in that environment, particularly before we had vaccines and, you know, we're still learning what kept us safe, what didn't keep us safe. But I always make that effort because, you know, I think it means a lot to people that their boss still has some understanding, even if it's not something I do every weekend kind of thing, but still understands what it's like to be a paramedic on the tools.
Don, with your experience in the paramedics over 30 years, I mean, do you look back, how do you look back over that time and think of all the different roles you've done over the time? How do you think the direction's gone, and is it something that you're very proud of where things are going in relation to not just the practical side of things but also the health and well-being side of things?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of angles to that one. One is the thing I'm most proud of is where the profession is going.
Right.
So, you know, as I said, I started as an ambulance officer, but I've always been passionate about taking the profession forward. And way back in the 90s, I actually represented New South Wales, the first national meeting ever to get registration of paramedics as healthcare professionals. It took us until 2018 to achieve that.
Is that right?
1st of December 2018, paramedics became a registered health profession in their own right.
That's not that long ago.
It's not. And so when you think about the incredible level of skill and intervention and independent practice that paramedics can do these days, it's such a far cry to the sorts of things that I was doing when I first started out.
So the evolution of the job and what you do in the job has changed so much. How does that change the approach? Like, to get that title to be recognised as a profession, what does that change for people working in the space?
Well, I've often thought that really being a registered paramedic was actually going to mean far more outside of the ambulance service than within. What I mean by that is it hasn't immediately changed the way that paramedics approach their practice necessarily within the ambulance service. They still do the same skills. They have the same scope of practice. Where it's a game changer is outside of the ambulance service.
Right.
So being able to work autonomously within local health districts, community practice, private enterprise, I reckon over the next 10 years we're going to see as many paramedics working in outside of ambulance services as we do inside. And today there's probably about 95% of all paramedics only work with an ambulance service.
95% of all paramedics work in the ambulance service right now, and you think over time that'll shrink?
Oh, absolutely, because the commercial market and the ability for paramedics to work in other contexts will just grow.
What's an example like that? You mean like someone within the workplace? Are you talking about somebody at events or organize, like
all those things? But a really good example, right, it's fairly common knowledge that we have a real GP shortage,
yes,
particularly in regional New South Wales. And you know, I was meeting with a number of GPs about some real concerns that they had about service delivery. And they told me at the time that there were 25 towns that in the last 5 years, they'd lost all general practitioners and they had another 25 that they believed would lose their GP in the next 5 years. And we're having this whole conversation because, as you can imagine, GPs are exactly the same as paramedics. They're really concerned about the people that they're responsible to look after. And a really good model might be that one small town where you've got a GP who has another small town not that far away from it, but the GP can't get out there all the time, might actually employ a paramedic to actually go out to that community, do all of the assessments, come back, report to the doctor and say, hey, this person seems to need a prescription for this or a prescription for that. And they tag team on the patient's assessment and care, and basically both communities get served. But there is an overarching medical model that supports that, and the paramedics get to work outside of an ambulance service.
Yeah, wow. So in that instance, would they be contracting themselves, their own boss sort of thing, or is it under a larger umbrella? Or
no, many ways. Many ways, right. They could do that. Certainly they could just go out and hang up their own practice shingle, but likewise they could be employed by New South Wales Health in the local health districts, a whole variety of things.
Right. So more of a diagnosis, a triage type role where they get to go out there and communicate that back to the doctor and then recommend the next course of action.
Yeah, and also now we have what are called extended care paramedics that will do, you know, their own assessments on complex and chronic patients and determine pathways. And sometimes that's actually far preferable, that you actually have someone else that can refer people off to other places other than emergency departments so that we can preserve those vital resources. And it might just be making an appointment with them with an aged care assessment team. It might be referral to drug and alcohol. It can be a whole range of things.
That could be incredibly useful, especially out there, like you said, in those regional areas. You can see the need for that.
Oh, yeah. And look, I think the model works because also if you think about it, being a paramedic, working in an ambulance service, you know, doing night shifts, working really hard, that's absolutely something that you probably don't so much want to be doing after you're 40. And yet for a lot of people, they don't have a lot of alternatives other than keep working with us. And a model that saw a really experienced paramedic work with us for 20 years and then go off into the regional or rural sectors and actually work, you know, at a time that suits them and suits the community, what a great model.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. I think that's what a great idea. I didn't know that was happening, but what a great use of resources and use of the profession or the skill sets of these people. So as we look at New South Wales Ambulance, over the years you've been involved, how are we finding the induction training process? Have you seen a bit of a change with that onboarding people and looking at their approach to getting them up to speed with what's ahead in the career and better sort of preparing them for that?
Yeah, so pretty much everybody that comes in now, with a few exceptions which I'll explain, all come out with a university degree already.
Right.
So again, you know, my vintage was pretty much come in the door, we'll teach you what you need to know. Good luck.
Yeah.
Don't make a mistake. And off you'd go.
And was there much practice theory around that as well? It would have.
No, comparatively, you know, back in the day, as it were, it was pretty much the minimum of what you needed to know and then get them out in the field and you'd pretty much learn as you go along. School of hard knocks.
Yeah.
Now everybody has to complete a 3 tertiary degree before they come in the door as a graduate paramedic. And you can imagine they're just so much more prepared for the role than we were. The way that the system has grown up and the level of skill and autonomy that they have to do now, there's just so much knowledge you've got to have to be a paramedic now that, you know, no employer could, you know, keep you off the road for 3 years, pay you a salary and you know, expect you to perform at that level.
Has that changed over the time, do you think, from when you first started, the things that they'll experience on the job now compared to when you went through it as well?
Yeah, they have. It's all part of it, but the proportions have changed.
Right.
Right. So when I came through, you know, primary health care with, you know, good GPs and care in the community, we're only really just starting to take. So we had lots of cardiac arrests would happen in the field. We'd have lots of people with heart failure, you know, fluid coming out of their lungs, the really big car crashes. You don't tend to get that these days, not in the same scale. So
right.
Cars are better built, you know, the cars will be written off, but people will survive it so much better. They have great GP care, generally speaking, and don't have nearly as many out-of-hospital cardiac arrests as back in the day. But what they do get is a lot more occupational violence. They certainly get a lot more mental health conditions within the community, And a lot of what they need to know about is geriatric care. So you can see the whole proportion has changed, whereas, you know, early on we would have just not heard from those people as a rule.
That's really interesting, isn't it? I think, what about as if you look at on-the-job training, on-the-job exposure to or educational side of things with trying to get people up to speed with their ongoing mental health and well-being, you're finding there's been a shift in that. And I'm guessing back in the day, they wouldn't have ever even spoken about such a
The shift in understanding and appreciation of mental health as being something that you have a personal responsibility to maintain your own mental health, as well as an employer responsibility. Quite frankly, we wouldn't have even discussed such a concept. Back then it was pretty much, well, if the job doesn't suit you, well, that's a decision you can make. I mean, it was terrible. You know, it has been such a journey for the organisation and first responder organisations everywhere that I think have collectively been slow to recognise the impacts of the unique nature of the work that we do. And the fact that it's moved even more beyond just having good support services for people after they become injured, but this real recognition, visceral recognition, I think, in organisations that the actual responsibilities start from the day you start trying to recruit people and trying to ensure that they have, you know, the appropriate levels of resilience and building even rosters and workloads as much as the nature of the work we get exposed to ensure that when they come out the other side of their career, they're as fit and as well as the day that they went in. That's got to be the goal. Even now, I'm still quite sure that in 5 years' time, we're going to look back and go, how did we not recognise that phenomena for what it was today? That's how these things and mental health within the first responder, you know, community are really ongoing and still got to be recognised into the future. A lot of work to do.
Yeah. Well, it certainly seems like we're heading in the right direction, and so too the organisation you work for, Dom. But if you look at the way things are heading with this, the workplace wellness stuff, as we're looking at it right now, New South Wales Ambulance has undertaken or has had some reform, has had the restructuring, there's been some new frameworks coming in. One of those in particular is the Next Normal Workplace strategy. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that initiative, what it is, why it was introduced, and what's going on with it?
Yeah, absolutely. So look, we came to, you know, with COVID, we came to a recognition that it simply wasn't going to be good enough to just accept that COVID had finished and we could all move on. And pretty much the last sort of 6 months of last year, we began as an executive to start to talk about how do we help our workforce move on from the experience of COVID. And you can imagine it has been really challenging for a lot of people. And I think one of the key things that we identified was there are still some of our colleagues that are really quite, it's a strong word, but really quite traumatised by their experience. This is the first time that emergency services workers were not only accepting a risk for themselves, but they are accepting a risk for their families. The risk that they could take this virus home to their mothers, their fathers, their children, their spouse, and they may actually die from it. And we worked out that, you know, some people had not even been able to articulate this to their own families. And so we decided that we actually had to really develop and document a meaningful long-term strategy to try and reconnect people into the workforce, to give them permission to move on, to acknowledge the fact that this had been one of the, probably in some cases, the most terrifying thing that they'd ever experienced in their entire professional career. And it was okay to move on from that. And so the Next Normal was all about engaging with the workforce to try and get a sense of the things that were important to them so that we could build strategies around that over the next 4 years is what we're looking for. So it's all about connectedness, rebuilding relationships, that sort of thing.
And so the process you went to undertake that, was that a matter of speaking to subgroups or forming different advisory boards or anything like that? Was it a survey? Was there that sort of input from the people on the front line?
Yeah, the whole principle was that it needed to be built from the ground up. If we went forward on a strategy like this that was top down, it was always going to fail. And so it started with pretty much all the things that you're talking about in terms of surveying the workforce, getting information from, you know, workshops, and particularly the information and feedback, obviously de-identified, that we're getting from our psychologists and chaplains and peer support officers about what the workforce were telling them. And we got the broad framework of that, and we actually ran a summit back in the middle of last year, and we brought 450 of the staff together to actually workshop what are the things that are meaningful to you that we can take these great ideas, and, you know, let's face it, we often talk about engagement and we talk about, you know, positive outcomes and things, but what does that mean? And so we're able to design a whole suite of programs that actually directly deliver on what the workforce asked us to do.
And was there pie in the sky type stuff? That was there a lot of suggestions that you couldn't implement, or was most of it stuff that you actually went away and executed on?
No, it was really actually incredibly pragmatic stuff. You know, some really good examples was just to be recognised, you know, just to be acknowledged for what they'd been through. And one of the things that we did about acknowledgement was that we ran a booth at the summit, and we let people come in and tell their stories in a safe place and record them on video. And we said, this is just for you to take home to their family. And so they could sit down and hear, the families could hear their experiences in their own words. Now, they'd never, you know, for many of them, even been through it. So you can imagine it was quite emotional for a lot of people. And then, you know, in terms of other awards, we actually struck a medal for our workforce for working through pandemic service. And we made a particular point of saying it wasn't about pandemic response, it was about pandemic service. On the 24th of December in 2021, we were just about to hit the peak of nearly double our workload and 000 calls, and we normally would receive 5,120 in a single day. And I had told all of the workforce from People and Culture who are not frontline paramedics that on Christmas Eve, I needed them all to come in to work and get me another 250 paramedics in the next 4 weeks. Every single one of them on the Saturday before Christmas came in, and not one person made any complaint. Nobody said anything other than came to work, did what they needed to do. Now, these stories would never be heard.
No.
And so we thought it was really important to recognise people, along with the frontline responders, for their contribution and effort to getting this state through, you know, a really terrible time.
How did you create that environment for them to be comfortable to come forward and talk about that? Was it something you just invited people to come forward and they, yeah, right.
Yeah, we talked about it in the morning and let everybody know that the opportunity was there. And it was quite funny, as you can imagine, first couple of hours, no one went anywhere near it. And then it was almost like you started to see a steady troop of people heading out to the confessional, and eventually it became quite normal. And but, you know, I can see a time where in 30 years, these people will be sitting down with their own children or their grandchildren, and someone said, I didn't even know you were a paramedic during the pandemic, Pa.
Yeah.
You know.
What was it like?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. What a powerful tool.
Hugely. But I think that's the whole point, that you've got to acknowledge these events. They're not normal. They are different. And it is kind of okay to go, I'm really struggling with this bit. And once you've acknowledged it, that kind of gives you the bridge to move on. And that's what we're aiming for with the booths at the summit.
That sounds really good. So a bit of the framework then. Let's talk to a bit of the framework with the next normal. So you had to go through, you had to reset normal so that you recognize what they've been through, but then also recognize the fact that things aren't going to be the way they used to be prior to this event happening. And this was an event that no one really was prepared for around the world, mind you. So dealing with the unknown, didn't really know how this was going to impact themselves, let alone their families, and undergoing through things that you would never expect to see in our lifetimes, with the way they shut things down, airports, borders, something you'd never even dream that would ever happen in our lifetime. But it was real and it was happening, and people had to go to work still every day facing the unknown. Tell us a little about this framework, and I understand the name New Normal, the Next Normal Workforce, but tell us a bit about how that you're trying to reset that.
Yeah, so look, it's really about the fact that COVID's going to be there, And if it's not COVID, chances are it might well be something else. Who'd know? But the point is, it's about saying, okay, well, that was then, this is now. All of those things that you talk about disrupt our relationships. Primarily, that's what it comes down to. You don't see your father as much. You don't see your mother as much. You may not see your friends as much. How are you actually going to ensure that going forward, knowing what we've got now, that you can still do all the things that you want to do and have a really positive life as well? And I think that that connection and reconnection, particularly around networks of friends, we know that isolated people have as a rule, poorer mental health outcomes than those that have strong social connection. And so one of the things that, you know, we're doing is there's a family support program that we have in place that we brought out deliberately to try and connect families back into the paramedic, and have the paramedic connecting into the workplace and create a relationship where we're all connected rather than just disparate pieces of a person's life. You know, because if a person gets into trouble, then you obviously need all those three pieces connected.
And COVID was such a disconnecting event, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely, across the board. We actually have paramedics who I distinctly remember were actually coming to work, doing their job and not going home. They were staying either in a hotel or, you know, removed from their family because they had family members who were potentially immunocompromised that they weren't prepared. So they were staying weeks and weeks and weeks at a time away from their family. So it's the ramifications of it were profound.
What about the work-life balance? Did that change as well during that time frame? I mean, to reset what's coming up, I mean, are we paying more attention to that and trying to be a bit more intentional?
I'd like to say we were, but look, you know, as a paramedic on the road, as a rule, your kind of work-life balance is as much about the when I go to work, how hard am I working? You know, these people were doing 14-hour shifts. Every shift was a two-hour overrun. That means that you can't see your family to have dinner of a night time, that sort of thing. You know, in terms of those that helped to run our response to COVID-19. So we set up what we call an incident management team pretty much from the January. We were really fortunate. We called it early, took a no-regrets policy and geared up as much as we can. But I've got to tell you, I still think that a very significant number of people are involved in, you know, the actual managing the response. Still haven't got their hours back to normal.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, because it's just ongoing and there's always more stuff to do.
Well, there was so much demand for services compared to a normal, or what would have been a normal foundation of what was expected day to day. So, I mean, the demand went up. You had this a limited amount of resources to go out there and do their job. Was there a sense of overwhelm and stress that was popping up amongst the workforce as a result of that? And I guess, secondly, did the way they came out of it, was there much of a follow-on impact to their psychology with how they're approaching their work?
Yeah, look, there is. And I'll answer that question in two ways. If you actually think about it, over the course of that time, we put on 1,000 additional paramedics, 250 call takers. We built more than 100 additional ambulances. We built a whole new control center training room. It sounds great, doesn't it?
Were they fast-tracking people through?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. By the bucket load.
Were they?
Yeah, we were just really fortunate that we had there was an oversupply of paramedics in Australia from the graduates from university at the time. The alignment of it was really fortunate. But when I say it sounds great, that's from my perspective.
Yeah.
Now, if you're a paramedic and you're in an ambulance and you've just waited at a hospital for 6 hours, you've been, you know, this is your 14th patient during the day, you could forgive people for going, is anyone ever going to come and help?
Yeah.
Right? When you're down there and you're experiencing this, not just one day, 2 days, but months and months, and then it goes on for years and years, you could start to wonder, is this ever going to stop? Because no matter how many resources we put in, how many more paramedics, how many ambulances we put on the road, it was never enough. Because there was just more and more COVID. To put it into perspective, New South Wales would normally get about 2,600, 2,700 000 calls a day. And as I mentioned before, our peak was 5,120.
Wow.
Twice as many. Like, that's unheard of. No other state came anywhere close to that. And you can imagine that there were a lot of people seriously wondering about their career choices at that time.
Why do you think it was New South Wales that increased so much as opposed to the other states? We just don't have the data on the other states.
No, we do, but primarily the big wave was Omicron.
Right.
And Omicron got loose in primarily in Sydney first.
Yeah.
And that carried us all through pretty much all of December of 2021 into January 2022.
Yeah.
What was so different about it from Delta, which was more back in the July of 2021, was that Delta had a much longer ramp, and so probably wasn't as contagious, was actually caused more morbidity and mortality. So we were probably in a better position, but some people didn't do as well. When Omicron came around, everybody got it, but fortunately by this stage, they weren't quite as sick as they had been, which was really, really fortunate. But every wave hit us in a different way. There was one challenge that was different about every single wave that we got that we had to adapt to.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Don't want to do too many of them in your career.
Oh, man, I wouldn't know what that would be like, obviously, but I mean, so much respect for people working, you know, on the front line for this and during this tough time. Was there incidences throughout that period as well of them receiving or being subject to abuse, verbal abuse? Was there much of those incidences happening for ambulance paramedic personnel?
Yeah, it still happens that pretty much almost every single, well, not almost every day, there is a paramedic that will be abused or assaulted somewhere in the state. That's similar to all states and territories. It's a terrible scourge of the profession. But those sorts of things, and, you know, when you overlay those other stresses like COVID, and you asked the question before about, you know, the paramedics' mental health through all of that. Absolutely, they were running on empty. Their resilience was down. There's absolutely no doubt that the chaplains, peer support, and our psychologists have never been busier. And I think that that's just a real testimony to just, again, why it's so important to have these things in place before these incredibly challenging situations occur rather than after. But absolutely, there's still a lot of people still trying to find their way back.
As you look at the organisation and the response on how you're handling it all, I mean, does the agility of the organisation, is it something that makes you quite proud, and that flexibility to adapt and evolve, is that something that you think is a real strength?
Huh. It's amazing. I often talk to people about the fact that New South Wales Ambulance is a 127-year-old boulder of an organisation. In so many ways, you think that it's, you know, the epitome of not change because it's so big, so large and so old. And then something like COVID happens, and if you said one thing to me about what did I take away from COVID, the absolute flexibility and agility of the people that worked in the organisation was amazing. Just amazing how everybody just lifted. And there is no way, as a chief executive, you could possibly have solved all of the problems if you didn't have 7,000 other people solving them for you. It was remarkable, and it is probably the proudest thing I've ever seen, is just how everybody just stood up and was counted. And I think people, as frustrated as people got, they understood it was not something that their employer had created, but we all had to lean into it to solve these incredible problems. Really simple and clever ingenuity that was happening that we were able to pick up in local areas and roll out statewide, and, you know, just really good ideas.
I feel like there was a whole new respect as well, frontline services that were operational during that pandemic and pivotal really in helping combat the fight against COVID and the variants that were coming through. I mean, you hear about the health workers and whether the nurses, paramedics that went above and beyond, massive hours, shift after shift, under-resourced, going through unknown events, stress, overwhelm. And coming through, I can imagine it'd be quite, coming out of that, like, how do you come, as an organization, how do you come back to that, not the next normal, you call it, but I mean, how do you go through that period with everybody So just giving everything they've got and then coming back out, is there a bit of a not a downer, but is there something where they go through a period of, oh, it's just flat?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's normal human nature.
Yeah.
And I think that's why this recognition of sort of saying we need to rule a line under it. Right. And yes, COVID hasn't gone away, but, you know, we are fully vaccinated now and, you know, touch wood, the outcomes are much better. And we certainly know how to protect ourselves a lot better. But you can't just go, oh, well, let's just keep on moving on now as if it never happened. Like it was a big deal and we need to recognize it as a big deal. And I think that's the bit that helps people to move on is just going, well, I can put that in my drawer now.
Yeah. And you feel like better equipped moving forward if another epidemic was going to happen? Do you feel like going through that experience, hopefully the whole health system is now planning and strategizing and doing a bit of a debrief and a post-mortem on what efforts were undertaken, what worked, what didn't work, to try and learn from that moving forward if it was to happen again?
Yeah, there was... actually quite a lot of work done right across the health system about how can we, you know, do deep dives on reviews and actually, you know, make the planning better. But, you know, I'd have to say we did get immense levels of support through COVID. And I think that our ability, every single time I put up my hand and I'd say, you know, like asking government for another 100 ambulances is a pretty big deal. Asking them to build us a new state operations centre because the next one, you know, who knows? We ask government for so much, but every single thing we ask for, one, was always building for the future. So it wasn't just the here and now.
Yep.
And the second one, we delivered. And we delivered in a really quick time. Whereas, so that way government could see that New South Wales ambulance, everything they've asked for is building for the future. And they deliver on what they've asked for. And I think that really positioned the organisation well for the future.
So Dom, as you look over your time with, well, you know what, within the whole, your whole lifespan of being a paramedic or being in the profession as a paramedic or related to that, is COVID something you're most proud of? Historically looking at getting over, accomplishing, what's been some highlights across the career to date?
I'm not sure I've ever heard anyone say COVID was your highlight, but what I can say is COVID lifted the lid on the historical challenges that ambulance service have had. I think it's a matter of record. It's not unique to New South Wales, but all ambulance services tend to struggle to convey our resourcing needs to government. Yeah. And the New South Wales government at last budget funded us another $1.76 billion over the next 4 years for another 2,128 paramedics and support staff. So that, I'd have to say, is a career highlight to say, finally, you know, this is a 40% uplift in the number of paramedics out there to serve their community. And what that means is that, you know, the paramedics get to go home on time. They'll get to get meal breaks. I know this sounds like, who doesn't get, paramedics more often than not won't get a meal break because who says no to an emergency call?
Yeah.
But you just got to have more there to do that. And that was what was recognised. And I think that, you know, that makes me really proud that we've been able to convey in a meaningful way the needs of our paramedics.
Yeah. And I think even just the pressure, the stress that would have the sector, the industry would have undertaken during COVID to be able to bounce back, to undergo through that experience, stay strong, stay together, get the job done above and beyond what was asked of them. I mean, it would have been such a, looking back on it, going, man, how did they do what they did with the people and the resources they had? I mean, it's something that's, I think you'd be incredibly proud looking back upon.
Look, if you spoke to most paramedics on the road, I think you'd find that they would say they got through it by leaning into each other.
Yeah.
They gave each other immense levels of support. And I think that's a character trait of a lot of the people that are drawn to this, that they not only care for their community, but they do care about their colleagues too. And you just can't do this sort of stuff and not share a bond, I think it's fair to say.
My last question, Dom, is, I mean, the culture of that caring, of camaraderie, of doing whatever it takes to get through the challenges. Obviously, it has something to do with the culture that comes from the top. But, I mean, tell us about the culture of the New South Wales Ambulance Service and also just the organisation caring for people, the role that the leadership team has to play in that. How have you found the culture?
It has changed so much over my time. When I joined this job, there were 40 women in the job, and we started another graduate course of paramedics only last Monday. Another 120 joined us, and I was curious about what does that mean for diversity. And as of last Monday, New South Wales Ambulance has a workforce diversity across more than 7,000 of us now. 49.4% are female.
Is that right?
Yeah, we are literally probably one course away from having complete gender diversity across New South Wales in the space of 30 years.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and I'm really proud of the fact that through no other mechanism than throwing the doors open to merit, there are more actual executive directors who are female in New South Wales Ambulance now than there are men. And it is just purely by accepting that best person gets the job.
Yeah.
Coming right through our operational leadership now, there are fantastically talented people who are educated and informed. And, you know, it was back when I sort of began in the job, it was really, very few people had degrees. Most people were from a trades background or something similar, or defence, or you know, any range of things. But I think the different demographic that's being drawn, people being qualified and educated, being curious, interested in the research, being quite self-aware about their own mental health and well-being, are really key attributes of the, you know, ambulance service and the culture of the ambulance service today.
Well, mate, it sounds like it's heading in the right direction, and it's, I mean, you've been through with the organisation for so long, and I'm glad that things are continuing to go in that direction, but there's been some strong leadership from you, Dom, and the rest of the team that's helped to forge that culture and that way of behaviour amongst the troops. So congratulations on such a great career to date, but also for the services you provide, and well done on the new strategy that's coming through and seeing some good results from that. So yeah, keep it up, and we appreciate your time.
Thanks again, Sam. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share with your friends and colleagues, and if you know someone working in mental health that you'd like to see featured on the podcast, please email any suggestions to us at membership@anzmh.asn.au. You can also stay up to date on our socials at ANZMHA on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you next week.